Well, the election is Tuesday, this presidential race featuring the first Mormon to be nominated, the first African-American to ask for a second term. And today we want to get a glimpse of these two aspects of the candidates from two outside observers. And we want to start with Mitt Romney. In a recent issue of Time magazine, veteran journalist John Meacham asked what Romney's membership in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints might tell us about him. And John joins us first. Welcome.
Thank you.
And you start with this idea of American exceptionalism, this notion that America has a special role to spread liberty and democracy. It's an old theory. How does the Mormon Church expand on that notion?
Well, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints' view of American exceptionalism is kind of John Winthrop on steroids. The idea that the country is a city on a hill, the phrase is from the Sermon on the Mount. The Mormon Church believes that the United States of America, that North America, played a critical role in sacred history. And in fact, that the site of the Second Coming will be in Jackson County, Missouri. It is a remarkably American faith. Joseph Smith, the prophet who received the visions that became the basis of the faith, was from upstate New York.
But it would seem to me that the only aspect of anyone's faith that we would be at all interested in is where faith might intersect with future policy. So where might that happen because of that view of America? How might that impact a Mitt Romney presidency?
The Mormon vision in terms of how it might affect public policy, the idea that American exceptionalism could shape what we do in the world is a vital, vital question. But interestingly, the Mormon Church is fairly conservative, if you will, about that. It doesn't really have the pitfalls that a more traditional Protestant or Catholic version might. The fear of exceptionalism is that suddenly anything we do as Americans is divinely sanctioned, which is a very dangerous way of thinking, obviously. The Mormon experience, this is the most fascinating thing about it, the Mormon experience is rather different. They believe very much that the Constitution was divinely inspired, but because of their experience, because of the history of the church, the persecution they suffered, they were chased across the country, they are actually much more interested in religious liberty and the freedom that is inherent in the Constitution, rather than taking the Constitution and investing anything we do with divine authority.
Well, but you raise the question of a theory that's discounted by most Mormons, but embraced by some. It's called the White Horse Theory, purported to be taken from the words of Joseph Smith, who said, "You will see the Constitution of the United States almost destroyed. It will hang like a thread as fine as a silk fiber," and that Mormons would be charged with saving the Constitution. And his words go on, "Power will be given to the White Horse," this Mormon who leads the charge, "to rebuke the nations afar off." You know, some people say that would raise questions about whether a presidential candidate felt he was destined to wage war. So tell us a little more about that theory and where Mitt Romney stands on it.
Yeah, the White Horse prophecy is not part of church doctrine. It does not seem, to my reading of things anyway, to be at all part of Governor Romney's worldview.
Actually, I found an interview in 2007 in the Salt Lake Tribune where he discounts it.
Yeah. To me, what's most interesting about how Mormonism has shaped Romney is less about exceptionalism and less about grandiosity and more about expedience. You know, the idea that the Mormon Church had to conform itself to reality through its history because it was always a minority faith creates a kind of culture of compromise, of expedience, of taking on the coloration of whatever area one might be in. And that, to my mind, again, is more relevant to the story of Romney because when you look at it, he has always tended to reflect the world that he was in at that particular moment. So when he was governor of Massachusetts, he was a moderate. When he decides to run for president of the United States in the Republican Party of 2006, 2007, he becomes conservative. In 2012, he becomes even more conservative. And then in the general election, in the first debate, President Obama walks out on a stage in Denver to debate Mitt Romney, who's been running for president, and Romney basically pulls off his Mission Impossible mask and becomes a centrist again.
And you think that's in part because of the history of his faith?
Yes, I do. I think that the idea that expedience is a Mormon characteristic is not to in any way cast aspersions on the strength of their conviction. It is simply a historical observation about the experience of the Mormon people in the United States. You know, there's a reason they're in Utah. They had to keep moving west to become a state. Polygamy, let me put it this way, polygamy as a practice of the Mormon Church went away about the time they needed to achieve statehood. There's a historical tendency to go along and get along.
We want to talk about one last aspect of the faith because people are wondering what a Mitt Romney would do to the social safety net. You write about the role of charity in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Deseret Industries, we know, is the equivalent of, you know, Goodwill or Catholic Charities. It's the Mormon Church charitable arm. The difference, we were told by a Mormon scholar, is that if a Mormon receives help, they're expected to give it back. For instance, if you get food from a food pantry, you may have to go work in one of the huge farms the Church runs. Now, a lot of people might applaud that accent on self-reliance. Others might be appalled. What's your sense of how the Church's view of charity might form Mitt Romney?
I think there is a streak of self-reliance, a hand up as opposed to a handout. And the sense of charity is that you do work very hard to help others within the faith community. And it's interesting, if not dispositive, to look at how that faith shaped him. As we know, Mormons are not a single voting bloc. This is a church that has given the world Orrin Hatch and Harry Reid and Mitt Romney. And so I think that it is in this search for clues about what made Romney and what he might do. I think his own campaign and his own style has, in a way, necessitated those of us who want to try to figure this out to go looking, because he has not articulated his own story particularly well. What I came away with was this is a very pragmatic, straight arrow guy who has the vices of his virtues, a deep streak of pragmatism and an analytical streak, a consultant streak that you try to figure out is a particular geographical area, is a particular place going to be congenial for you to practice your faith and live your life. There's a tradition. This is part of the air that Mormons have breathed for so long. And I think that of all the possible angles of vision on Governor Romney, I think that his faith is a very legitimate one.
That's journalist John Meacham. He wrote a cover story on Mitt Romney's faith. By the way, John's newest book is Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, steeped in this stuff. John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we are curious what our Latter-day Saint listeners think about that analogy. Let us know. HereAndNow.org. And up next, President Obama, the first black president who's had to demonstrate he would be president to all people. That's next, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back. We're hearing about the presidential candidates through their unique prisms. Before the break, Mitt Romney's Mormonism, and now Barack Obama, the first African-American to ask for a second term. Last Sunday, Washington Post White House reporter Peter Walston wrote about how Barack Obama has struggled to find the right balance on race. And Peter joins us from the Washington Post studios. Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
So, in this case, we already know some of the effect of the president's uniqueness, and it's mixed. You write about the inspiration, the little African-American boy who asked to touch President Obama's hair to see if it was like his. And on the other hand, you have Cornel West, Tavis Smiley, criticizing the president for not doing more for the poor. You have Columbia professor Fred Harris, author of The Price of the Ticket. He says the price was blacks faring less well under President Obama.
Well, what I found interesting was the fact that even though this administration and this president tries to convey that race is not a factor for him, privately, it is a big issue for him, and he does struggle with it, and he struggled with it for his entire political career.
Yeah, you talk about a coaching session for a debate very early on where he finally, you know, stops the session and says, you know, look, I can't sound like Martin or Jesse. You know, he had this deep sense he couldn't be what some people wanted him to be.
That's right. And, you know, it's interesting. I mean, that in one sense, you could say that he was practicing. And that's what he was doing. He was practicing not just how to speak, but how to speak specifically to African-American voters. And at that point, that was a debate prep session in 2007. He was losing the black vote to Hillary Clinton. He was still trying to figure out how to connect with black voters who would eventually become his most loyal constituency. But at that point, he was trying to walk a very fine line, which is to communicate and connect with them, but to try to remain true to himself. And he's not a preacher.
Well, staying within the African-American community and their thoughts on this, I mean, you know, some questioned his status when he first ran because he wasn't raised in the pre-civil rights South, but in Hawaii and Indonesia. And there were moments during his presidency when he did claim his race. He called out the police here in Cambridge who arrested a black professor in his own home. He said if he, Barack Obama, had a son, he would look like Florida shooting victim Trayvon Martin. So he did make little forays.
He did. He didn't. He's not hidden from it. I mean, it's no secret that he's African American.
Right.
The issue has been how much can he be a black president as opposed to being a president? I mean, he wants to be a president who happens to be black. But the political reality is that he needs that constituency to be very supportive. And I think he also does feel a cultural connection, but he has had to walk that fine line. You know, he has been very defensive, too, when he's been accused of not being true and not being loyal to his people. You know, he really, at one point, chewed out Cornel West during a confrontation they had in 2010. And he had a private conversation with Shirley Sherrod, the former Agriculture Department official who had been forced out when her comments were taken out of context. You know, the president had a phone conversation with her. She challenged him and said that she told him that he just didn't understand the world the way she saw it because she was from the South and did grow up in segregation. And he really defended himself and said, no, 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 I do understand it.
Yeah. Well, and this is within the black community. What's been the impact on whites and others in America? You had that AP poll last week showing racism up in the last 4 years.
Well, there was the AP poll and our Washington Post ABC poll shows that this might be the most racially polarized election since 1988. I mean, Obama did really well among white voters for a Democrat in 2008. He won 43% of whites. That support, according to our poll, is now down to the mid to high 30s, I think 37%. So he's losing the white vote by 23 points to Mitt Romney. That's a big slide for him. And whether he wins or loses, you know, this is going to be a very racially polarized electorate.
Well, and of course, there are people who voted for Barack Obama in 2008 and are maybe not going to do it in 2012 who will say it has nothing to do with race. I was disappointed the economy didn't turn around more. But I know there are people throwing things at the radio right now saying, of course, there's more racism. It's a sort of a natural outgrowth of this sort of almost a social experiment. You know, the first African-American president, you had people fanning those embers. You had Glenn Beck saying Obama hates all whites. You had Rush Limbaugh playing the song Barack the Magic Negro. But the black commentator Touré is turning this around. He writes, you know, yes, Barack Obama is not the magical Negro anymore. He's been brought down to earth by the politics of the past 4 years, including Republicans who pledged not to let him be successful. But Touré says that's a good thing because his slight edge now in the polls shows voters are embracing a non-magical black man.
Well, you know, this president had to change his presidency after the debt ceiling talks fell apart. He decided that he was going to go back to his base and be much more of a partisan Democrat and that was going to be his path to reelection. And the core of the Democratic Party is African-Americans. It's Hispanics. And if there was one group that where the vote, if he was going to lose support, it was going to basically have to be white voters because those were the swing voters. No. for a president like President Obama.
Look, blacks have been pushing him, as you write. The conservative black entertainment mogul, TV mogul Robert Johnson, was pushing a plan like the one the NFL has to push companies to interview at least one minority candidate for a managerial job. The Black Caucus called for a plan to send more money to areas that had been under the federal poverty line for at least 30 years. And this would include whites in rural America, but also blacks. Is there a sense, what about going forward? We only have about a minute and a half here, but going forward, is there a sense that we might see, I don't know how else to say it, a blacker president?
a lot of African-American supporters of the president do believe that in the second term he would be freed up to be more of a black president in addition to being the president. We have no indication from the president himself that that would be the case, but that's the belief.
And we have really no indication from the president, except for a couple of comments, at all how he feels about his blackness.
That's right. I mean, there are private conversations. There's one I reported in the story that he had with an old Harvard mentor of his, Charles Ogletree, in the Oval Office a few months after the Skip Gates incident, where the president reflected on how he was going to start taking more risks with regards to his race, and he was feeling a little bit more confident. But these conversations are few and far between, and he keeps it very close.
Very close to the vest. Peter Walston, White House reporter for The Washington Post, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And so we've just taken a glimpse at how two unique aspects of these presidential candidates has maybe informed them. Love to hear your thoughts. African-American, maybe disappointed in the president, maybe understanding of this, as another African-American politician said, the raindrops he has to walk between. Let us know, hereandnow.org. Latest news is next, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world, extension.harvard.edu, and the Institute of Contemporary Art Boston, with Os Gemeos, colorful dynamic paintings by Brazil's most renowned street artists, on view now, icaboston.org.